morning.
Hello, welcome.
Thanks for hanging out with me this morning. My name is Jesse. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. For most of the show today, we are going to hear part of a conversation with Elder Jerry. So I don't have a ton of time to talk to set this up, so the piece itself will give you an introduction, and we will reconvene near the top of the hour. I'll talk to you.
My name is Robin Erickson, and I am joined with Jerry Oleman, who is a member of the Stat Liam Nation from Shillalath, BC, and has been involved as a change agent for First Nations communities and agencies since 1976. His experiences include providing counseling for individuals, families, and groups, and providing leadership politically and administratively to his community and nations. Jerry came to the realization that all First Nations in Canada have the same suffering and challenges. All challenges are man-made, therefore they can be healed and fixed using the traditional laws that have worked for thousands of years. Over the past 14 years, Jerry has facilitated over 640 workshops across Canada and in the United States. First of all, I want to ask you about your name, because I've seen different places, you know, over the last week or so, that in some places it's Jerry Oleman, and in other places it's Jerry Oldman. Which is it?
Actually, it's both. I guess in my identification, it's Oleman. But I was helping my dad take down a house that he built, our first dwelling that him and his father built. So I was taking down the shingles because it was covered in shingles, cedar shingles. And I pulled one down and it said, Patrick Oldman on the back. And I said to my father, hey, Dad, they misspelled your name. He says, oh, no. He says, it used to be Old Man. I said, oh. And he says, and it's the first time I ever thought of names, our names in particular, Indigenous. And he says, oh, yeah. He says, my grandfather, your great-grandfather, was the first one on our side to get an English name. So when the Indian agent came out, because they done a census and they're creating the Indian reservations. So he comes out and he's giving people names, you know, families. But it sort of mixed up a lot of things. But anyway, so he was filling out his census and he says, and who's that man? And he pointed to my great-grandfather. And the interpreter says, oh, it's the old man. Because, you know, his family, they were known to a long time. So they said that's why they called him the old man. And the Indian agent says, oh, okay, we'll call him Patrick, old man. See, Patse, rather than Patse, they put Patrick, old man. So I said, oh. Then I'd seen other records later, and there's Henry Oldman, my dad's uncle, William Oldman, my dad's father, then my dad, Patrick Oldman, until he was filling out government papers. He was filling them out, said, there's no such name as Oldman, it's Oldman. So they changed it yet again. So when I do public speaking, I go by Oldman, because people can remember that. Oh, I was listening to the old man, you know. So on my, but on my, when I sign a check or something, it's Oleman. And you know the interesting thing about this identity, because it caused a lot of identity problems. My first status card, because they give you a number and a card, was, and I looked to where it come from. And it came from the Department of Immigration of Canada, you know, giving me my identity and a number. So it was like I was an immigrant. So that's how my name came about. And many people, they got their names from the Bible or who they were working for. So the names were, it's just, when I think about it, right across Canada, everyone was getting new names. And in our culture, names are given because they're passed down or there's a meaning behind a name. So that's how I got to identify myself at times as Jerry Oldman. Yes.
Well, that's a good segue into my next curiosity, which is about the designation that you have as an elder. And what does that mean to be a First Nations elder? How is this designation bestowed upon you or upon others who also hold that title?
Okay, the elders are teachers, are educators. You know, they know the protocols. The word protocol actually means a glue that holds things together. So our protocols and ceremony and land use, food use, all of that. There were elders that carried the knowledge. And, some elders are quite young, actually. But I think a lot of it is around how much knowledge you carry and how you share that knowledge. I didn't go through a formal ceremony of being named an elder. It come more from, Canadian institutions, as well as Indigenous, like Friendship Center Society and things. They would view me as an elder. Because the elder is viewed as someone that has knowledge, knowledge keeper, has experience, but we're actually motivators, inspiration, help people with healing, so there's elders that know all the food, that know the medicines, that know the music, so there's different, I guess you can say there's different types of elders. Like there are some that are canoe makers, for instance. I want to build a canoe. Oh, go see that elder. He's got all the teachings on how to build a dugout canoe or a birch bark canoe, so those are the elders, the knowledge keepers.
And so the knowledge that you are the keeper of would fall into what category?
It would be our part of it is our laws of how to be as a human being. I'll pass on words that have been passed on to me or teachings. They call them teachings. For instance, to be careful and sincere with your words when you're speaking to anyone. And I was told by an elder that it's like a bullet leaving a gun. It can cause serious harm. It can actually cause death. But it also can be healing. Be very careful and sincere with your words when you're speaking. So that means so much in a sense of preventing bullying, the different things that we see today, people not being careful with their words. And I think the critical part of it is about being sincere. Like I was told, when you say something to people, you mean it. When my elder was teaching me and said, don't you dare play with that word love. You mean it. If you tell someone you love them, you mean it. Don't use it to gain for selfish reasons. He says, be sincere. It's so interesting for me, because I was reading a book and it was about Buddha. And they were saying his last words to his followers was, above all, be sincere. So our elders had the same teaching about sincerity. Don't put on airs. My granny, squashaha achut. Don't dare think you're better than other people. You're better than anyone. Because it'll hurt you, eventually come back on you. Not only you, but your family. You know, so the cause and effect teaching was critical and was, you know, there were so many laws that, for instance, just preventing greed. So that we're all taught it's a group thing. It's a clan thing. It's a family thing. You know, participate, be a part of. Don't just stand around, you know, all of those things that would, I guess, would bind us together. I could say, okay, let's go and make sure no one's left behind. So we move as a group. So that was, to me, you know, like, for instance, in the berry camps, the salmon camps, you know, and deer hunting, you know, they'd move together. They'd work together. My late mother and uncle were telling me about the berry areas in my territory. They said they were talking, they're reminiscing. We'd go up in September for the blueberries and deer, because we're going to dry deer for the winter. And my mother said, yes, and someone would put this huge covering on the earth, hides sewed together like a huge blanket. And everyone would put their food on that covering. And then there would be a couple that were known as to be group cooks, would be the cook for the camp. They would do all the cooking. Because everyone would be going out, children, you know, and adults would be going out picking berries, and the men would be hunting for deer, mountain goats, and things like that. So they all had a common kitchen. And she says when they were all done, and they were picking literally, I'd say, tons of berries for the winter. And they dry them, and told me how they dried them so they'd be like a cake. So they're flat, you know, and they're just right so they won't get moldy. And they'd shape them so they could stick them when they get home and also for carrying. She said they'd put all the berries on that same place where the food was and the meat. Then they would divide and would have enough. It was fair. It was that true sentiment of we're all one. We're all one. And we must take care of each other. So those teachings of togetherness, like tie yourselves together in times of trouble, you know, are what created our society. A society of peoples in Canada, what they call Canada, where there was nothing going extinct when they were by themselves in their own territory, because they had responsibility to take care of the land and to teach respect for it. You know, and I just love that when people talk about seven generations, what it means is that, for instance, for me to help create a life, because a generation is what we called 80 years. Seven generations means 560 years from now, my descendants are going to have water and food. I must work. So if all of us followed that teaching, you know, our descendants, when we're not even here, would have a good life in this beautiful land called Canada, rich in resources that people are now reckless with and actually causing harm because they don't carry that teaching of seven generations. Just that teaching by itself, you know, would do a lot for climate change and global warming. If people could, the elders would say, if you absorb the teaching, you will live that teaching. If everyone in Canada can absorb the teaching of seven generations, because then we take responsibility for our actions and what we're doing and what we're part of, then it would be a different life. Because in what happened, because I've come to realize that everyone on the planet at one time were hunter-gatherers. They belonged to clans, and, you know, they had their groupings, and they had their steward laws of the land. They were stewards of the land, too. They followed the herds. They picked the berries. They done all that before the industrial and agricultural revolution. And it shattered the family systems. It became a pyramid system of you get to the top, and you get there. It doesn't matter how you get there, you get there. And you look, and I think, and I hear university students so concerned about their grades and wanting to get to the top and stressing and worrying about it. I say, no, help somebody, and then somebody will help you. You know, work together and getting these gifts of knowledge at your institution. But I feel that sentiment that what was let loose by very few human beings to create a society that would feed the top people. You know, and those ones don't know when enough is enough. And our measure of a person, you would have huge status in an indigenous society. If you would feed the whole community, oh, people would recognize you and you'd be an important person in a sense. And they would give it to you. Like one of my aunties said, everything you give comes back to you. It might be a big circle, which means it might take years to you, but it will get come back to you. So cause and effect is a huge awareness that were put into children right away. Soon as there were, my grandmother says, as soon as we knew there was a baby, my grandmother was a midwife. A mother was carrying a baby. All the laws around that kicked in. No negativity around that mom. You know, she couldn't go to certain ceremonies and things, you know, because the baby was forming. And she said, we start teaching that baby right away with good teachings. And we don't let that mother be in negativity. Otherwise the baby will absorb it. She says, the baby absorbs everything like a sponge. Everything coming through the air. So they're developing that citizen right from there. That feeling of inclusivity was huge. You belong, you're part of. That's a wonderful feeling to have, that you're never alone. So our society developed those ways and how to respect everything that keeps us alive. Water, the berries, the animals, the birds, the plants, the air, that we're all part of this. We all need each other. You know, and that's when I think of those teachings, I knew why our people were healthy. Because indigenous populations before contact with Europeans were very healthy. The word health means to be sound in mind, body, and spirit. If your mind is sound, we can teach you, you'll absorb knowledge and you'll reflect it back. You become the echo of the teacher, the reflection of the teacher. And your body is, I was listening to presenters in Vancouver, researchers in health sciences. And this one group was studying the bones of indigenous people before contact. And that report they gave was, they said they could not find degenerative diseases in the persons before contact. So we were very healthy. They lived to a great age, like my great-grandfather was 105 when he passed to the spirit world. That's an indicator of being healthy. So we're a very healthy population before contact. You know, and I was reading that, I do a lot of reading, and I was reading about Europe in 1492. The average age of a European male was 45 years of age. Because of the plague, you know, the Black Death, the pandemics, you know, the hygiene, the diet, all of those things. Because remember I said they were all tribal too. But then all of a sudden they're growing in really crowded conditions in London and Paris and all these urban centers. And they became unhealthy. So the only male would live. You're lucky if you go past 45. Meanwhile, here we are, 100, 105, 110, you know, and healthy, sound. Then the third indicator of a healthy person is a sound spirit. That means you have an incredible to live. It doesn't matter, like right now it's negative 35 outside in Brandon. And I'll go out there, I'll park up and do stuff, and I'll go walk around. I still want to be an active participant. Doesn't matter how cold it is, or how hot, or how many mosquitoes, or pandemic, or anything. I still got this will to live. The second indicator is that they want to be successful at everything they do, from washing dishes, to being a partner, to being a sibling, to being a friend. You want to be successful at it, a student, whatever it is. You're taught to do your best. Be successful at it. Then the third indicator, which is the one that I think that held us together, was you're kind. When your spirit is good, people can see it. They want to be with you. They see you and they call you. They can feel your energy. Because it's you're kind. You got good words. You help. You give. You take in a good way. So that's a healthy human being. I do. I've done a lot of lectures for health sciences, and I would ask the students and the faculty, "What does the word health mean in the dictionary? Who can tell me?" 250 students and faculty member, not no hands shooting up and saying, "I know," because when I added the word dictionary, they thought about it. Then that's where I discovered that many people, including myself, were using words in context we didn't even know what it meant or where it came from. You know, so, yeah, so. That's our people before contact. You know, very healthy, organized. I've read accounts of Europeans coming. They visited a community called Bella Coola now. And they seen how they organized their longhouses and how clean their village was. And the guy is writing in his log book was saying, "If only we were like this at home." He's talking about Europe. You know, that we were as organized and everything was just so. You know, so anyway, so that's where I come from as a person, and that part of my as an elder is to give a point of reference of where we come from, who we are. Because a lot of people have grown up in trauma, indigenous people included, you know, poverty, you know, loss of language, loss of ceremony, loss of traditional foods, knowledge. So part of my job is to remind people and teach what I know. And because those teachings were laid at, and it's my responsibility to pick it up, but also not only to absorb it and use it, but to pass it on, to share it with others. Yeah. It's a long answer for
It's a big responsibility.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that would be a big answer. But what it makes me think about is the distinction I think that's being made now between intent and impact. Mm-hmm. And, I certainly hear those two distinctions being bandied around more than ever. And in much of what you said, I could hear, that was really part of the underlying message or teaching, is that you're always considering what the impact is rather than what the intent is, because it's the thing that matters. You were just saying how, loss of culture and language and traditions have been such a big part of First Nations lives. And, part of that has really been brought to light with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and it being in the news and, the stories of residential schools, both the experiences of and more recently with the graves. What is your own experience with residential school?
I went to Kamloops Indian Residential School, and I left there in 1968, and I used the words, I heard it somewhere, so I copied it, and I said it was a breeding ground for dysfunction for the attendees, the ones that attended. Because we went home and became parents and we were dysfunctional individuals, so there were dysfunctional families as a result. Not all, but many. And it was, I heard a term once, I accompanied many people through civil court process and residential schools, that it was it was a spirit killer, the residential school. Because you remember when I said spirit, and one of the indicators of a sound spirit is you have this incredible... When I left residential school after my experience in education, it was very violent and humiliating, and it filled me with fear. We absorbed or we internalized the messages. Because the country was constructed on the attitude that Indigenous people were inferior to Europeans. And it was shown through the language that was used by Canadians, early Canadians, and some still today. Oh, those Indians are stupid. They're crazy, they're lazy, they're drunken. So they started to... there's a created identity for my people. And I grew up in that created identity. It wasn't my elders' identity. They didn't say, no, that's not us. But as children, when that's put into you, it sort of deletes some of those elders' teachings and sentiments until you regain it. So I went there, and when I left, I lost my will to live. I became addicted to alcohol and drugs. I had suicide ideation, abuse of any kind of a child and, young adults, because teenagers are young adults. If they don't get help, they're carrying that day in, day out. I would hear people say, why can't those residential school survivors get over it? That was a long time ago. In my mind, I'd say, I want to get over it, but it's not going away. I say, don't think this way. Don't remember those things. Go away. I don't want to remember my abuse. And it wouldn't go away.